On Thursday last, the 55th ceasefire to be announced in the Lebanese fratricidal war went into effect. Bombs continued to fall on Beirut, and there was fighting elsewhere in that unhappy land. But there is reason to believe that the crest of the fighting is behind us. In the Middle East, tempers flare easily and bloodletting begins easily. Tempers are slow to cool down and bloodletting is slow to end. But there is reason to believe that the major powers involved in that fighting have come to the conclusion that what they wanted to achieve has been achieved. And so, though it is safe to say that there'll be more dead and there'll be more blood, I think it's also safe to assume that the worst of the war is behind, and that in time the war in Lebanon will fall away from our headlines. It's important to recognize that this last ceasefire was negotiated not in Beirut, but in Riyadh. Not by an underling in the bureaucracy of the Arab League, but by King Khalid himself. King Khalid has been sponsoring, Saudi Arabians have been sponsoring the Syrian intervention. The Syrian intervention is costing that little country about $1 million a day. They cannot obviously afford that kind of cost. But apparently Saudi Arabia has decided that what she wanted to achieve, which is to say the reining in of the radical left, but not their ultimate defeat, which would drive them underground into it, become a terrorist organization which might threaten the rich, conservative lands of the South, has been achieved. Syria, the Syrian army now controls 75% of the land of Lebanon. And on the ground, there is in effect a set of lines which rather neatly divide Lebanon between those lands which the Falangists and the Maronite Christians have traditionally held, their villages and their settlements, and those areas of Lebanon which are heavily Muslim and Arab. And so the possibility of some kind of political arrangement, some kind of cantonization, now actually exists. The Syrian army has won a series of battles with the PLO and the Arab left at the Tel el-Zaatar garrison of the refugee camp in the mountains to the east of Beirut near the port of Sidon. And she has not had to force the PLO into a final battle where the destruction would be such that bitterness would be unleashed, which would lead to an underground guerrilla terrorist attack on Syria and on Saudi Arabia and her allies, the kind of attack that none of these governments want. Syria was unhappy with the prospect of a radical group in control of the lands west of her, even as she is unhappy with the Iraqi radical government to the east of her. She was afraid of being caught in a pincer between these two groups. Syria has always assumed that Lebanon is by rights a province of Greater Syria, and she now has effective hegemony over the Lebanese territory. Her aims have been secured. The Christian groups in Lebanon have gained all they could possibly gain, and the Palestinians have been beaten, and they simply are threatened with further defeat. So many things are in place which suggest that the time is maybe ripe for a winding down of the Lebanese war, and not least of these is the fact that the American election will take place just in a few days. And that after the election is over, the Arab world will want to present to whatever administration in power, for it will be a new foreign policy administration. Clearly, whatever happens, Secretary Kissinger will be out, and President Ford will, if he is reelected, will appoint his own Secretary of State. Or Governor Carter, if he is elected, will appoint his own Secretary of State. There'll be a new American policy. And the Arabs are concerned that they face America with a united front. So there are many indications that the crest of this war may be behind us, and it may slowly wind down. There is now, as president, established as president of Lebanon, a man, a bureaucrat named Eli Sarkis, who does not have any blood on his hands. He has not been identified with one group or the other. And I suppose that the Arab governments hope that given the time which will be allowed Lebanon because of the presence of this 30,000-man peacekeeping force which the Arab League is raising, Sarkis may have an opportunity to successfully adjust the very complicated clan feudal arrangements which must be adjusted for any kind of stability to emerge in that country. But before we put Lebanon behind us, I think it's important that we look at Lebanon and try to understand why the Lebanese situation became the violent confrontation that it did, what it represents and what it can teach us about the Middle East. Because it's important for us to know all that we can know about the realities of the Middle East, because so much of what we think about the Middle East is conditioned by our own experience, which is totally foreign, totally strange to the facts of life, to the political facts of life there. As always, as we look at a situation in the Middle East, we have to look back into history, back to the 19th century in this case. In the 19th century, Turkey governed all of the Middle East. But Turkey was a bankrupt empire, and Turkey was gradually losing its ability to govern her empire. And more the prefecture, which is called the Lebanon, was slipping away from effective Turkish control, which was organized largely from the vilayet of Syria and Damascus. And around 1860, the small Druze and Maronite communities of Lebanon began to engage in a Hatfield and McCoy kind of blood feud, which grew in intensity day by day. It was great bloodletting, not unlike today. And at that time, the West, particularly the French, were eager to establish Beirut as a commercial capital, as an effective banking and marketplace for their economic penetration in the Middle East. And this bloodshed was getting in the way. So the Western countries forced Constantinople to allow them to intervene in the Lebanon and to impose a kind of enforced peace. And so they did, largely under French domination. And then at the end of the First World War, as the West began to divide up economic areas of privilege in the Middle East, the French legitimatized their authority in the area by gaining a mandate from the League of Nations, not only to the prefecture that was around Beirut, but to a greater Lebanon, which would include almost all of the major Christian settlements in the area. For the Christians had turned to the West and had found themselves sympathetic to the Western commercial concerns. And the French had learned in the previous 50 years from the Christian Maronite settlements, particularly in the Lebanon, what it meant to live under Arab domination. That you could never be an equal. You always existed on sufferance, on tolerance. That you always had to give in to a religious force more powerful than your own. There could be no political equality. There could be no guarantee of public safety or of citizenship rights. And so the French and the local Christians determined to create a state where there would be a guaranteed Christian Arab majority, which could guarantee the rights and the security of the Christian groups in the area. And that was achieved with the mandate of 1921, in which the French were granted governing power in the Lebanon. And the French then imposed what was called a national compact. The national compact looked at the various feudal divisions in the Lebanon and granted to each of them the various Druze groups, the various Christian groups, the few small Muslim groups, specific representation in the parliament. You had, depending on your group, so many seats, and those seats were guaranteed to you for as long as the Lebanese parliament would exist. There was to be an enforced and unchangeable proportional representation, one which would forever guarantee Christian dominance of that parliament in order to guarantee the Christian community equality, rights, and security. Now, as things developed, Lebanon became the most prosperous of all of the Arab states of the Middle East, and many poor Arabs from Syria, from Iraq, began to be drawn into Beirut, and they were all Muslim. And the Arab birth rate proved to be higher than the Christian Arab birth rate. And slowly the proportions in the population began to change. And so at the end of the Second World War, when imperialism was no longer possible, Lebanon was granted a flag and independence and national status. But in fact, Lebanon was not a country in any modern sense. There was no national will. There was no sense of national unity. What you had in the Lebanon were a series of competing groups organized by this national compact fixed in their political power, but no, these groups no longer represented the actual facts, population facts as they were in the country, and these groups were no longer equal in their degree of prosperity. The older Christian Arab group was far more prosperous, far more oriented to the West, far more conservative politically. And the newer Muslim Arab groups, Islamic Arab groups, were the poorer, the proletarian, politically more radical, and politically more demanding, obviously, of a new order of things. And finally, in 1948, there came into the Lebanon, at first they thought only for a few days or a few months, those who fled on orders from Israel, being told that they'd be able to go back to their lands as soon as the Arab generals and armies had reconquered that part of the world. And these people, these Arabs, almost all of them Muslim, formed themselves into so-called refugee camps, garrison camps, and became another fact of life in that country. And you may recall that in 1957 and early 1958, when Nasser was at his height, groups of young Muslim Arab Nasserites took to the streets in Beirut and Sidon and began to demand a new order, a change of government, a change of the proportions of representation, better advantages, more advantages for the underclasses, the less privileged, a closer representation in the government depending upon one's numbers. And they demanded an end to French influence, an end to the influence of the West. And for a while, there were attempts to adjust these demands, and finally, the Christian right was so frightened by the possibility of a coup d'etat that General Eisenhower was encouraged to send the American Marines again to the shores of Tripoli. And the Marines went into Lebanon and put down this Nasserite kind of rebellion. And that first Nasserite attempt to overthrow the existing order of things in Lebanon is the direct forerunner of all that we've been seeing these last several years. It was aborted, and those pressures went underground, and they began to resurface more recently. But between 1958 and 1974, 75, when the present bloodletting began, another set of events added to the tensions and the crisis of the area. The Palestine Liberation Army, which was increasingly radical, increasingly geared to the overthrow not only of Israel, but of all the so-called established powers of among the Arab governments themselves, was chased out of the Jordan by King Hussein early in 1971. The armies of the PLO were very badly beaten in a series of battles in northern Jordan. And Habash and Arafat and the other leaders, together with their tanks and mercenaries and Hessians and armies, went to Beirut, and settled in Beirut, and became part of the political life of the country. The Lebanese tried to buy off this new dominance above the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is largely Muslim and Arab and radical, by granting them virtual control of a large piece of territory in the south of the Lebanon, which borders on Israel, the so-called, what came to be called, Fatah land. In that area, the armies of Habash and of Arafat had complete authority. The armies of the Lebanese people were not to intrude. And it was from that area that the attacks were mounted at Maalot and Kiryat Shmona, these other attacks which caused such bloodshed in Israel. But the Palestine liberation groups were not satisfied simply to have control of an area from which they could launch attacks on Israel. This was very much the era in which they were cock of the walk, confident of their own power, emerging, so they felt, as a major power in the world. Wherever they went, in the third world, in the Arab world, in the communist world, they were feted. Arafat had his great moment on the rostrum of the United Nations when, gun on his hip, he was able to denounce Israel and to be applauded by the governments of the world. This was the time when they were able to strike at the very heart of Munich during the Olympics. This was the time when they could strike at ease at air transportation and at Israel, that they could kill American diplomats in the Sudan and not be viciously punished for it. They had a sense of power. And the young intellectuals of Lebanon who were Muslim and Arab, who had always had this series of grievances, found a new source of impetuous authority. They sensed that their moment was at hand. Many guns were at hand. Many explosives were ready at hand. There were tanks to back up the demands. And new demands were made of the existing government. And for a while in early 1974 and early 1974, there was an attempt by the more conservative groups in Lebanon to adjust the various balances of power in the Lebanon to meet the new demands. But then it became clear that what the groups of the left wanted was not simply more representation in the parliament, but a complete reconstruction of the political order. And this was frightening. And more frightening yet was the recognition that what was really happening was a submergence, again, of a large Christian Arab group under the dominance of a large, powerful Muslim Arab group, which was going to insist that it and it alone had power, that all others who lived in that part of the world would be subordinate and would have rights only by sufferance. And out of that came the bloodshed. First there was an attack, and then revenge, and then revenge on the revenge. And the clan war broke out. The private armies took the field, and the result is history. About 2 years or 3 years ago, a very sensitive observer of the Middle East, Professor Eli Kaddouri, wrote about Israel and the Arab world the following sentence. And what he said about Israel and the Arab world is equally true of the Christian Arab community of the Lebanon and the Muslim majority in that part of the world. He wrote, "The real issue is the right of the Jews, hitherto a subject people under Islam, to exercise political sovereignty in an area regarded as part of the Muslim domain." In traditional Muslim theology, there is a geographic concept called Dar al-Islam, the land governed by Islam. Any country which has been conquered by the sword of Islam is part of Dar al-Islam. And in Dar al-Islam, there is only to be the true believers. They alone are to have power. All who are pagan and idolaters are to be exiled or killed, and those who are monotheists are to be allowed what is called the dhimmi status. Christians and Jews may be allowed to remain on sufferance as a subject people, but they are never to be allowed to exert any authority over the true believers. Dar al-Islam is to be run by a religious political group, by sheikhs and imam who are devoted to Islam and who will govern according to the laws of Islam. And the Islamic world has had far too little experience with the separation of church and state ideas of the West, modern times to have come far from this medieval theology. But one of the facts of life in the Middle East is that the Middle Ages is only a half a generation behind. Most of the Middle East is just now emerging from the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries. And they're going through their American Revolution, their French Revolution, and the Industrial Revolution, the Technological Revolution, all of the changes of modern life in very short order. But psychology and culture and ethos, attitudes change much more slowly. And this old assumption that Muslims must have absolute power in Dawl al-Islam remains the dominant one. It is for that reason that the Christian Arabs of the Lebanon have known that if they once allowed a Muslim Arab group to become dominant, they would be reduced to second-class citizenship. They would no longer have rights, they would only be a tolerated group. It's for that reason that they fought, and fought so desperately. And part of this whole theology is what's behind the inability of the Arab world to accept the possibility of an Israel, of a Jewish state, of a state where Islam does not rule in a part of the world where Islam, for a period of time, in fact ruled. It is inconceivable to the Muslims that there should be Muslim minorities in countries where once the Crescent reigned. The real issue, Kaddouri wrote, is the right of the Jews, hitherto a subject people under Islam, to exercise political sovereignty in an area regarded as part of the Muslim domain. The Christian groups of the Lebanon know that when a man like Arafat speaks of creating in a greater Palestine a secular democratic state, these are only words designed for Western propaganda. The concept of secularity, of democracy with equal rights to every individual, are totally foreign to the ethos of the Arab Middle East. They may come in half a century or more, but they are foreign to the ethos of the Middle East as it exists in this period of time. So we've come to that point of time when there's going to be a kind of stabilization in the Lebanon. And it's important, I think, for us to ask, well, what now? After Lebanon, what? For clearly, the last few months in which the Lebanese situation has dominated the headlines have granted to Israel a breathing spell. There's been very little pressure on Israel this last half year or so to move back unilaterally from this point or that to return to go to Geneva for an international conference. There's been a growing recognition in the West of the reasons that Israel is so preoccupied with security. I have a good friend who's on the board of trustees of the American University in Beirut. I saw him recently and he said to me, you know, all that you've been telling me all these years about the potential for violence, for cruelty in the Arab world, I didn't believe. But I've seen it now. And I understand why Israel is so concerned with borders, armies, defense. There's been a recognition, I think, in the West that the Arab world is a much more primitive world than any of us had really imagined. That old feudal bitterness quickly erupts into blood feuds. That the so-called Arab countries are not really countries in any modern sense with a sense of national unity and a national will, but really agglomerations of competing millet groups, tribal groups, who have not yet emerged into the level of nationhood. Israel has been able to score a few political points. Israel was being accused, you remember, after 1967 and 1973, of being an imperialist state, eager to expand its borders whenever it could, whenever it wanted to. Well, obviously, in the last months, Israel could have walked over the southern Lebanon without any contest, but she stayed behind her borders. And obviously, there was a possibility of creating, as Israel in fact did create, the open fence policy to show to the world something of what Israel is really about, to allow the wounded of that war to come to the Israeli hospitals and to be healed, and even more significantly, to allow those whose farms had been destroyed by the war, who were thrown out of work by the war, to come to the Israeli fields and farms and factories and find employment. Israel has actually been employing thousands of people who were thrown out of work, Lebanese, who were thrown out of work by the Lebanese war. And so these have been relatively calm months for Israel. And when, towards the end of this period, we had the very dramatic rescue of the plane load, the hijacked plane load from Entebbe Airport, a magnificent example of the derring do and technical expertise, there have been a number of people, I think, among us who have come to feel that the situation has changed. Things are looking up. That is, the situation for Israel is not really as tense as it once was. I wish that were so. But I'm afraid that Lebanon has been a diversion and has made no substantial difference in the real issues of the Middle East. Let's remember where we were before Lebanon. After the Yom Kippur War of 1973, Israel found herself occupying large amounts of once Arab territory on the Golan Heights, in the West Bank, in the Sinai, even parts of the West Bank of the Suez in Egypt. And the proposals that were made for the end of that war by various groups, particularly in the United Nations Security Council, envisaged a slow process of mutual give and take. Israel would return real estate as the Arabs granted Israel an interbelligerency status, and then ultimately, hopefully, some kind of legitimization and recognition. There were to be a quid pro quo. Israel would retreat in measure as the politics of the Arab world advanced towards a recognition and acceptance of the status quo, that is, the existence of the State of Israel. And for some months, there was hope that the United Resolutions 242 would be a basis for a viable adjustment of differences in the Middle East. But the Arabs proved adamant. No Arab government was willing to give any political concessions, to make any political concessions to Israel. There was an impasse. And at that point, the United States embarked on a new policy called even-handedness. And Secretary Kissinger embarked on a new form of diplomacy, which came to be called shuttle diplomacy. You moved here and there every day between the various capitals of the Middle East. Now, what was even-handedness? Well, on a theoretical level, as presented to the American people, even-handedness was the proposition that we wanted to be friends to both the Arab world and to Israel, and that we could have most leverage with the Arab world and Israel if, in fact, both recognized that we had their best interests at heart. But in reality, even-handedness was no more than the recognition that the business of America is business, and that the purpose of American policy was to make it possible for the great banks of the United States and for the great industries of the United States to enter the marketplace of the newly rich countries of that part of the world, particularly the oil-rich countries of the Gulf. The Arab oil embargo of 1973 had resulted in a fourfold increase in oil prices. There was a great demand for goods of all kinds and services of all kinds. And even-handedness was really a policy which recognized the interest of many groups within the United States in selling goods, in maintaining a flow of oil, in having banking and commercial relationships with these new, very, very rich sheikdoms, which overnight became the most prosperous countries on the face of the earth. Even-handedness meant that whatever the Arabs wanted commercially, if it could possibly be given to them, should be given to them. That Israel was not to be allowed to stand in the way of American commercial interests. And so as even-handedness and the shuttle diplomacy worked out in between Israel and the so-called confrontation states, the United States took the role of the Arab states. The United States said, in effect, if the Arab states will not guarantee to Israel what she wants, we will make certain guarantees. If Egypt will not guarantee recognition to Israel or an end to belligerency, we will guarantee sufficient arms to Israel to protect herself. We will guarantee economic aid to Israel so she remains economically viable. And if she's concerned about returning, say, the Abu Rodis oil fields to Egypt because she has no indigenous oil supply, we will guarantee to Israel from American sources Iranian oil or Mexican oil that she will not want, Israel will not want for oil. And Secretary Kissinger was able to get from Sadat vague statements about reducing the level of anti-Israel propaganda across the world, but very little more. And Israel, on the basis of American demands and this new American policy of even-handedness, was ultimately forced, really, to make the two major drawbacks into the Sinai, the first across the canal, the second to the center of the mountain range, which she has now completed. Even-handedness was the statement that American business and the needs and desires of American business were to govern our relationships in the Middle East. To the degree that when Saudi Arabia comes to the United States, as she has this year, and says, we want to buy from you $7.5 billion worth of arms. That's 1/7 of the amount of money the United States government is spending to arm the United States Army. $7.5 billion worth of armed purchases in 1 year. No questions are raised by the American government as to whether these arms are offensive or defensive, whether the Saudis can really, in effect, integrate these arms into their own defense system. What a little country of 6 million people, 3 million of whom are illiterate and Bedouin, can possibly do with $7.5 billion of the most sophisticated arms the world produces. No questions are to be asked, because these arms sales are good for our military-industrial complex. And because along with the arms sales go the architects and go the shipping interests and goes Chase Manhattan Bank and all of the commercial interests. No questions are asked. That's even-handedness. And it seems clear to me that the pressures of even-handedness, that is the commercial pressures, which have been very evident in the way this administration has not handled the attempts to prohibit American companies from involving themselves in the Arab boycott of Israel, it's very clear to me that these pressures will be very strong in Washington, whatever administration is in power after January of next year. And that bold statements of one candidate or the other, notwithstanding, they will be very effective in governing the interests and the attitudes of our State Department and of our foreign policy. Obviously, the major issue in this campaign has been the economy. Obviously, one way of maintaining prosperity is to sell goods abroad at a good rate of profit. Obviously, one of the most attractive markets for American goods is the Arab world. And obviously, ways will be found. And nothing should stand in the way of the frequent purchase by these countries of American goods and American services. Which is to say that Israel will again come under pressure to make a contribution to peace. Which is a euphemism for saying that Israel will be asked to pay part of the price of American prosperity. Which is to say that it'll again become popular in many circles to begin to see Israel as intransigent and adamant, and to wonder why Israel will not unilaterally withdraw to American, to her, say, 1967 borders, then we'll have peace. And there'll be frequent Barbara Walters, Anwar Sadat interviews in the media, in which the great president of Egypt will tell this great American newswoman that, yes, Egypt is interested in peace. Oh, perhaps not peace with Israel in his lifetime or that of his children, perhaps in his grandchildren's lifetime. And yet there may be recognition of Israel provided she withdraws to her legitimate borders and provided she accepts the legitimate rights of the Palestinian peoples. And everybody will assume that that means that if only Israel will withdraw to the borders of 1973 or 67, If only she will guarantee certain repatriation of funds to the so-called refugees of 1948, all will be peace and happiness and sunlit in the Middle East. But no one has ever been able to pin Mr. Sadat or any other person of power in the Arab world down to what are Israel's legitimate borders. Is he speaking of the borders of 67? Is he speaking of the borders of 1948? Is he speaking of the borders of the UN resolution of 1947? What is he saying about Jerusalem? And what are the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people? Are they simply the rights to create a canton or a state in Gaza and the West Bank? Are they the rights to reclaim all the lands which may be claimed by them in all of Israel? Same way, let's say, the Indian tribes are claiming large pieces of land in the United States. Are they going to, are Palestinian rights the rights to exclude from Israel all those Jews who were not in Israel before 1948 or before the Balfour Declaration of 1919? No one has been able to pin any Arab head of state, Assad, Sadat, or anyone else down, to what they mean when they begin to speak for American consumption of, yes, there is a possibility of certain adjustments. The real issue is the right of the Jews, hitherto a subject people under Islam, to exercise political sovereignty in an area regarded as part of the Muslim domain. That remains the issue. And it's an issue at which the Arab states, heads of state and states themselves, have not yet realistically and openly confronted. For what is said to us, to the West, is not what these leaders are saying to their own people through their own propaganda agencies. They have not yet abandoned the hope that there will come a day in the not-too-distant future where, after Israel has been returned to smaller, shorter, more less defensible borders, they can begin to put pressure for further concessions, for the further weakening of Israel, and ultimately to her undoing. And inevitably, given the scenario which has been set into being by this policy of even-handedness, given the interest, the economic interest of the West, all the countries of Western Europe and of the United States, in gaining profit in the newly rich kingdoms of the oil Arab world and in maintaining the flow of oil from the Arab world, given this new scenario, Israel must inevitably be painted in the corner where, whatever she does, she will be seen as intransigent, as mulish, as standing in the way of what the West really wants to accomplish. I'm afraid that we who are part of the larger community of Israel, the people of Israel, will often be pressed in the days ahead by well-intentioned mercantile and commercially oriented people in the United States to explain why Israel is being so intransigent. And the reasons are simple. Israel wants to remain Israel, alive, a state, able to secure her own destiny. And there will be all kinds of pressures exerted by whatever administration is in power in Washington in order to make Israel do those things which the Arab world tells Israel, tells the United States they want of Israel, in order for the United States to continue to enjoy the openness of the markets, the profitability, which now accrues to us from the oil-rich kingdoms. What has been gained from Lebanon? A year, time. And time's very precious. I remember a political observer saying to me about 5 years ago, if only Israel can last till 1980, she's home free. Perhaps it's 1980, perhaps it's 1985, perhaps it's 1990. But at that time, when the energy crisis begins to diminish, when nuclear energy and other forms of energy have come on the line, when the Arab world is no longer the source of energy for the West, that point of time, and only then, will Israel be secure. Because then there will be no reason for any country in the West to lean upon Israel, to force from Israel the concessions which will allow those countries to make profit, where profit is to be made, and to guarantee their own employment, their own prosperity, because energy is guaranteed. The most difficult thing that has happened to Israel in the last year or two is the failure of the United States to establish any kind of energy policy. We are now twice as dependent upon Arab oil as we were in 1973. The most encouraging thing that has happened to Israel in the last year is the recognition that she has an effective government which can make hard decisions during a turbulent time, and that she is able to restrain her interests and to secure her interests, and she will know what needs to be done. And the real issue that faces us, the Jews of America and the Jews of the world, is whether we will have the patience and the guts to explain the very simple, basic equations of life in the Middle East to our non-Jewish friends, whose businesses stand to profit if Israel will only be less intransigent. Amen.